wanted a chance to make law. Well, here it is. Make it a good one.
Is this your gun?
No.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
We have your name on the registration.
No, you don't.
Don't be ridiculous. Networks don't get to decide elections. Courts do.
Your Honors, I'm not some slick big city lawyer like my opponent here.
What just happened? You kind of confessed. Sorry.
And I find you guilty. Bring out the wheel of punishment!
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 474. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew. How are you doing, sir?
I'm fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
I'm fantastic that you're fantastic. not only do we have a great show, I just can't hold it in a moment longer, Andrew. Cop Rock with Eli Bosnick coming to a lot off of movies near you this weekend.
Yeah.
Eli Bosnick, for anyone who doesn't know, is one of the funniest people on the planet, and Cop Rock is one of the most ridiculous things that you wouldn't believe exists, and we're going to do Cop Rock episode one. Now, I had to get Cop Rock from like a guy in a parking garage, you know, like it was the methods that I had to use.
It will be a challenge if you're one of the people that like to follow along and watch the shows before we do a lot of awful movies. You may find it challenging to find episode one or episode anything of Cop Rock.
Yeah, it'll tell you online, oh, watch it on iTunes, but that's actually mislabeled. It's not the right show. So it tells you like, yeah, you can rent it on iTunes. No, you can't. This is
humanity trying to help you. Yeah, oh, somebody to watch the show.
No, some executive or somebody like wanted to bury. I'm telling you that this was buried. This show, we're gonna blow the lid off this thing. Cop Rock. You may have seen it first on on John Oliver, but we're doing the deeper dive as we always do.
Always, and I have done research into the background of. I'm super excited about this.
Gonna be so fun. Yeah. So fun. Hop onto that Patreon, everybody. Or if you're already there, just keep refreshing every 60 seconds until Saturday. All right. Hey, what's going on over on aisle 45?
Oh, we had a DOJ heavy episode on Wednesday. It was a lot of fun. We had a really, really good interview with Adam Fernandez about Vanita Gupta, who, you know, not somebody I knew a lot about in terms of Biden's nominee to be assistant attorney general. And I came away from that interview very, very excited, not only about her, but about what that meant as a nomination, right? Putting somebody whose expertise is voting rights law is a pretty strong indication that the Biden administration gets it. You know, they understand that these are not just battles over process, but this is really the full-on Republican strategy for maintaining relevance and power despite being a minority party. And again, like, I couldn't be more proud to be a member of the political party that is trying to expand political participation rather than restrict it. So that was that episode. What about the latest SIO?
Ooh, science lovers. I had, so Lindsay is always on the show starting a new podcast of her own with a physicist. And so I had them on to talk about quantum physics. And we were going to talk about the what the bleep do we know just for fun, like to into some quantum woo. But it's so like trying to set everything up, it turned into a quantum physics kind of 101 sort of thing, which is just my favorite thing. Like I've probably listened to the same quantum physics lecture and going through all those things a million times and it never gets old to me. It's like one of my favorite subjects because it's so weird and so complicated that I can't really retain it each time. So that anyway, if you're into quantum physics and want to hear about some amount of quantum woo and why it's BS, check out Serious Inquiries Only.
I am very, very excited to listen to that episode, because every time I think I have a good handle on, like, you know, the basics of quantum physics to be, exactly.
Double slit experiment.
To be able to talk about it intelligently as a layperson, right?
Like, That's what I do. It's same with you when you ask me any legal term, the definition. I'm like, oh, I know what that, oh, I can't put it into words. Like every time, I'm like, well, I think I know. No, I don't know it enough to be able to rephrase it in a way that sounds smart. It's like that.
Yeah. And I know, right? Like, I have no hope of ever understanding the mathematics, right? Like, mm-hmm. That's beyond this lifetime for me. But to be able, like, to conceptualize it on a level of, like, oh, when they make this reference on Star Trek, like, should I be angry or happy, right? Like, that's what I should.
Well, according to the physicist I had, always angry. Like, oh, nice. I asked him how, you know, he's like, I can't watch anything. I just don't, you know, some people, I would think some people would be able to just like, ah, I'm not going to think about it. But he's like, nah, I don't really watch any sci-fi. I can't handle it. There's so much quantum stuff around. Like, I see where he's coming. Anyway, we got so much to talk about today.
Yep.
So let's get into it. So this is something I've missed. And I can't wait to hear you tell me what this is. An investigation into Kavanaugh? How did I miss this? Oh, what's happening?
Oh, yeah. So yesterday, Sheldon Whitehouse, the senator from Rhode Island and author of the single most important amicus brief of the past decade, sent a letter to Merrick Garland, to Attorney General Merrick Garland, raising five issues, right? And all five of these are really, really important issues. I'm going to talk to you about 1, 3, 4, and 5 first. And then the second one was Kavanaugh. That's where we want to sort of do the deep dive. So first, and again, each one of these we could do a segment on, requesting that the DOJ continue its tobacco-like investigation into the fossil fuel industry, right? So, and here, there are points of disanalogy, but the common thread is the allegations of fraud against the major manufacturers, right? Like, that's what blew open the cigarette case was, oh, yeah, the cigarette companies knew in, like, 1907, like, oh, yeah, we're killing people by the millions, and hid that research, buried it, failed to disclose. And so the question is, did the fossil fuel industry do the same thing with respect to the toxic effects of producing fossil fuels, right? And using fossil fuels. It's a huge, huge inquiry. It was opened in the Obama administration, and then, you know.
What did Trump do with it?
Yeah, shockingly, not pursued. And so that was sort of point one in the letter. We'll link the letter in the show notes. You can go read more on it if you want. Point three was an antitrust investigation into separate agreements that various auto manufacturers made with the state of California regarding CAFE, right? The fuel standards, which are supposed to be at an average of 51 miles per gallon by 2026. So,
wow.
White House wants to know what's up with that, right? Item number four are IRS referrals for unlawful political activity by nonprofits. That is a huge issue in light of Citizens United, where you can funnel sort of unlimited dark money into campaigns. 501c4s that engage in political advertising are required, right? If you engage in any political activity of any kind, it's not prohibited, but you have to check the box that says yes on the IRS form. We've talked about this before, right? And lots of dark money outfits that are supporting candidates, supporting awful causes, and probably some that are supporting good causes, right? Like this is for sunshine, for disinfectant, have answered no on the IRS forms. No, we're not engaged in any political activity, when they're very clearly engaged in political activity. And the DOJ's policy up until now has been to await referrals from the IRS, right, for criminal tax fraud. And what Senator Whitehouse wants the DOJ to do is initiate investigations on its own if the IRS isn't going to refer out any cases. Because if you wanted to guess the number of criminal referrals involving 501c4s that fraudulently answered no on their applications while conducting political activities, what number that starts and ends in zero do you think the IRS referred out over the past 4 years?
Zero, one, zero?
Zero, yeah.
No, just zero. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it never happens. So
I wasn't sure if that was a Pork Bar Exam question or a you question, you know.
And then finally, and I like this because this is almost, my heart goes out to Senator Whitehouse as he wrote this about the Office of Legal Counsel. And I'm going to read a sentence, right? I am not sure what should be done about the Office of Legal Counsel, he writes. But, like, look, we all know it's that Trump turned it into an office of hackery, right? Like, look, under the best of circumstances, it provided cover for presidents who, you know, wanted John Yoo to write a memo that said, yeah, torture is fine, right? Like, it OLC has always been, oh, my boss wants me to write a memo that says the thing my boss wants to do is permissible. Wonder where I'm going to turn out on that, right? Like, but first let me impartially evaluate the evidence. No, like, it's always been crap, but, like, it became, you know, a double crap Sunday with whipped crap on top of it during the Trump administration. So, so those were the four kind of other points. Like I said, we could drill down into every one of them. The Kavanaugh point has gotten a lot of attention, and rightfully so. The language that Senator Whitehouse uses here is not mincing words, right? He says, quote, "The second matter of concern is what appears to have been a politically constrained and perhaps fake FBI investigation into alleged misconduct by now Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, rather than what FBI Director Chris Wray promised, a background investigation, quote, consistent with the FBI's longstanding policies, practices, and procedures." And he points out that the FBI failed to interview Christine Blasey Ford. They failed to interview Max Steyer, the widely respected president of the Partnership for Public Service and a college classmate of Brett Kavanaugh's, who offered specific corroborating evidence. The FBI just refused to interview him. The FBI set up a tip line, but, and here I can't do this any better than Senator Whitehouse has already expressed it, quote, "This tip line appears to have operated more like a garbage chute, with everything that came down the chute consigned without review to the figurative dumpster." It's a strong, strong statement made in public by a very prominent person who, again, you know, Sheldon Whitehouse, if we said this on our show, you would be like, okay, fine, whatever. Sheldon Whitehouse, not a bomb thrower. I'm going to be keeping an eye on this as to how it's received, what Merrick Garland says in response to that request that the FBI reopen the investigation, that they provide an explanation for the stonewall of questions related to Christine Blasey Ford. Again, from Senator Whitehouse, "If the investigation was conducted with drawbridges up and a fake tip line that was somehow by the book, that would raise serious questions about the book itself. It cannot and should not be the policy of the FBI not to follow up on serious allegations of misconduct during background check investigations." I would expect to see some action taken here, and then, you know, go ahead and ask the question that I know you're getting ready to ask.
No, well, maybe I've been trained out of asking such questions, but I'm sure people are wondering, so does that mean we could get rid of Kavanaugh somehow?
And the answer is, we could. It is very, very unlikely, right? The remedy, Article III judges serve for good behavior, right? It's a slightly different standard.
It's impeachment, right?
It's impeachment. But look, a dozen judges, Article III judges, have been impeached in our history. Certainly lying to Congress in your impeachment hearings is grounds for being impeached and removed from the bench. That again, the standard isn't even a crime, right? Like, it's not like, you know, what counts as high crimes and misdemeanors or whatever. No, it's just for good behavior. And obviously, you know, it falls short of good behavior when you lie to get onto the bench. Again, is that going to persuade 10 Republicans?
What do you mean? Particularly, 10? Isn't it like 17?
You are correct. We need to get to 67, not 60. I was thinking in the back of my head, you know.
Yeah.
You know what I was thinking of in the back of my head. Like, to do anything, we need to persuade 10 Republicans. Yeah, persuading 17 Republicans is almost certainly impossible. But let's see.
Right? Yeah, I mean, it's worth saying, like, here's how things should work if the world was fair. You would be like, oh, my God, what a miscarriage of justice this thing was. And then Republicans would be like, yeah, you're right. This guy shouldn't be on the bench. And then you could impeach him. But that's not going to happen. I guess it's worth showing the process, like, of what should happen and maybe going through the motions. But we all know it's not going to happen.
That's right. Although, you know, look, you could reach an accommodation with Mitch McConnell if
we'd give him another Trump justice or something.
Yeah, no, but for example, right, you could certainly say, here's the political cover that I will give you. I, Joe Biden, will nominate, you know, 85-year-old Lawrence Tribe to the bench in place of Brett Kavanaugh. Right. So on the one hand, right, yes, you will be replacing a right-wing activist with a liberal justice. On the other hand, it's the person who is the smartest person on earth about constitutional law. So, like, there's no question of fitness. And, you know, it's not like we're finding our own Justin or Corey here who's, you know, 37.
You're living in a fantasy land, Andrew. I mean, yeah, come on. Probably. People, if you've been listening to the show for 4 or 5 years, this is not happening. This is this is a Democrat hoax. Investigation was, they was fine, cleared. This is, I'm not going to listen to that. You know, that's what'll happen. No, not even Mitt Romney would vote for this, I don't think. But don't mistake
it's
that
highly
for like,
optimistic.
Into the investigation. Let's do all that. Let's, you know, let's air those wrongs and like make sure that, you know, if we need reform there, if people need to be fired, by the way. I want a full accounting. I'm not saying do nothing. I'm just, you know, just saying we're not getting an impeachment of justice. It's not, I would bet any amount of money on that.
You're probably correct, but, you know, you're harshing on my Optimus Prime buzz here.
Well, you know, there's optimism and then there's optimism, Andrew.
Fair enough.
Down. 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 All right. Well, let's talk about the latest lawsuit against the Recovery Act. What's going on?
And this, by the way, is an Andrew was wrong from last night. If you were one of the couple hundred folks who listened to our Q&A, I was just getting the pleadings and I had, you know, skimmed very briefly over them. And my answer was incorrect. So apologies if you heard that sort of speculation last night.
You should have just left it to only the stereo folks know you were wrong. Everybody else, he's always right. He wasn't. Wasn't wrong.
That's what the Q&As are for. I'm much more willing to kind of go out on a limb and say, I think it's X. Turns out not at all. So here is what you need to know. Top line, Ohio is suing to block only one tiny provision of the American Rescue Plan Act. And they're not going to succeed for the reasons that I'm about to tell you. But it was super interesting figuring out what their complaint was. It reveals, I think, so much about the American Rescue Plan, about the hypocrisy of Republicans, and about a little known and infrequently discussed legal doctrine on the show called the anti-commandeering doctrine.
Ooh.
So we're going to do a deep dive on this right now. Starting out at the top, episode 472 is when we broke down the American Rescue Plan Act. And one of the things that we said in the overview was that it gives a lot of money to the states, right, mm-hmm. and to the District of Columbia. I cut for time the discussion of Section 9901, but if you have your American Rescue Plan Act up, and you know, if you don't, what are you doing listening to the show without having the documents up? I'm a little disappointed.
I sleep with mine.
Yeah, you should. And so turn to page 220. That is section 9901, and that allocates $195 billion to the states, just direct aid from the federal government to the states. And subsection C1 tells the states what they can do with it, right? And they can do one of four things. A, they can respond to the negative economic impacts of COVID-19 with direct aid to households, small businesses, nonprofits, or impacted industries like tourism. B, they can provide premium pay to essential workers. C, they can use it to provide government services that benefit people that have suffered as a result of COVID-19. Or D, they can invest in water, sewer, or broadband infrastructure.
Hmm.
And that's it, right? No other things. And again, because this is a great bill, because this is a Democratic bill from start to finish, Democrats realized what a big giveaway of a huge chunk of money to red states might cause to have happen. And go ahead, like Negatron, imagine you're Governor Kristi Noem and you get $2 billion as a result of this direct aid package. What do you think Kristi Noem is going to do with that $2 billion?
Oh, well, there's so many possibilities because I know on one, I'm not sure what you're going for, but there's a lot of possibilities. A, they could just take credit for it, as you said last show or two shows ago, just be like, hey, I'm doing this Republican. Hey, look at this. Or,
and the bill is fine with that, by the way, right?
And
as long as people get benefits, it decentralizes the credit.
But the other thing is, I know with Obamacare, they turned down a bunch of free money just despite the first black president. You know, like they could have expanded, what is it, Medicare, Medicaid, whatever the thing is. They could have expanded their healthcare with free money, basically, refused to do it. I'm not sure if that's what you're going for. Your tone sounded a little different than that. It sounded like you were suggesting they would use them for some other nefarious purpose,
Exactly right.
Yeah, but it seems to be pretty spelled out in the bill there what they can use it for, right?
So here's what Democrats were rightly concerned that red state governors would do. Take the money, squander it on stupid tax cuts, and then say, oh, well, look, this tax cut is meant to stimulate small business, that counts as subsection C1A, and ha, ha, ha. So they wrote in, that was subsection C1 has those four things that you can do. They wrote in subsection C2, which basically says, no, you can't do that. Says, quote, a state shall not use the funds provided under this section to either directly or indirectly offset a reduction in the net tax revenue of such state resulting from a change in law, regulation, or administrative interpretation during the covered period that reduces any tax by providing for a reduction in a rate, a rebate, a deduction, a credit, or otherwise, or delays the imposition of any tax or any tax increase. So pretty
smart. Case closed.
Yeah, absolutely. Case closed. You can take the money, but if you take the money, you have to actually spend it on your people, not do stupid Republican stuff with it. So Ohio's pretty bad because Ohio wants to take the money and use it for tax cuts because of course they do. So they have filed this lawsuit and they are suing for an injunction to block only C2. That's the no tax cut portion that I just read to you. So in other words, they want the money. This is not like the Obamacare, like, oh, no, we're definitely not going to. Like, they want the money, but they want it no strings attached. And they want to be able to use it to give tax cuts and then take credit for being a tax cut governor. And get that to drum up votes against the Democrats in their state, even though zero Republicans voted for this bill. So that's the lawsuit that they filed. And it is based on the anti-commandeering doctrine, which we have discussed exactly once in 474 episodes of the show, way back in OA episode 175. This is a little bit of a memory question, but it's also totally unfair.
I failed. And, I already failed. Either
you're
of
allowed
two.
To get it wrong. You're allowed to get it wrong. Counting English common law, Thomas, when do you think the first anti-commandeering case was?
Oh. So we're like commandeering a chariot or something, like some sort of like a horse. Ooh, the sheriff of Nottingham maybe comes in and I would say 1580.
Yeah, 1992.
Oh, okay.
It was so right. No, and that's why I set you up that way, right? Because anti-commandeering sounds like right crazy old-timey Sheriff of Nottingham language. It's a thing that was invented by Antonin Scalia, and the idea is that the federal government cannot commandeer the state legislature and tell them what to do. So in the entirety of our nation's history, we have had three cases at the Supreme Court that have involved the anti-commandeering doctrine. One in 1992 called New York versus United States, which invented it, in which involved the Low-Level Radioactive Waste Policy Amendments Act of 1985 about where you could store toxic waste. And basically, it was like you can't tell the New York state legislature that they have to store the toxic waste in New York. Then, 1997, Scalia case, which held that the Brady Bill provision requiring states to conduct a background check using the best technology available in each state was in violation of this imaginary made-up doctrine. And again, this was particularly galling because, again, that provision of the Brady Bill that said have localities do conduct the background checks, that was a compromise to Republicans and conservatives, right? Like it was, okay, we won't have a big intrusive federal government. The bill will just say in your state should conduct a background check. And then, you know, they immediately sued to say, oh, well, you can't tell the states what to do under the anti-commandeering doctrine that's existed for all of a minute and a half as of right now.
Wow.
Then anti-commandeering sat dormant for 20 years. Never went anywhere. No cases applied it until the one we discussed on our show, Murphy versus NCAA. And that was overturning a particular federal law about gambling on college athletics. So you can go back to OA episode 175. You can hear our breakdown of that case. We try to be fair sort of on both sides. The basis for the anti-commandeering doctrine is the 10th Amendment, right? And the 10th Amendment says the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, right, nor prohibited to it by the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. And this is a way of reading the 10th Amendment as constraining what the federal government can do under the Commerce Clause. It's kind of weird when it morphs from a direct instruction to the state to incentives, right? Because incentives, right? We're going to give you federal dollars so long as you do X. We've been doing that for 200 years. You were nodding along, but like you probably remember that the nationwide adoption of a 21-year-old drinking age was passed during the Reagan administration and was tied to specific federal highway funds. This was the National Minimum Drinking Age Act of 1984, signed into law by President Ronald Reagan, July 17th, 1984. It said that any state that allowed individuals under 21 to purchase alcoholic beverages, that was targeted at Louisiana and the French Quarter, which allowed 18-year-olds to drink at the time, would have their federal highway budget reduced by 10%, right?
And so it just made states do it? So states could hypothetically still not do that?
Correct, yeah.
Oh, wow.
States could hypothetically still give tax cuts, right? You've got two different options here in this particular bill, right? You could not take the money, which Ohio really, really wants to take the money. Or read that C2. It just says you can't use that money to fund the tax cuts. If you want to fund the tax cuts from somewhere else, that's totally fine. This doesn't say if you're a state and you take the money, you can't cut taxes, right? Yeah, you can say, okay, we're going to eliminate this statewide program. That's going to save $300 million, and we're going to fund these $300 million in tax cuts over here. All it prohibits you from doing is using the federal money, which is earmarked for a particular spending purpose, to use it for some other purpose. And the Supreme Court has never held that that constitutes commandeering a state legislature.
Yeah, that's
never
silly.
ever. Now, let's go the other way. This Supreme Court very easily could just invent something new out of whole cloth. But in order to get there, right, remember that what's happening here is this is a lawsuit brought by the state of Ohio seeking injunctive relief. And as we know, Thomas, in order to get injunctive relief, what do you need?
Probability of success on the merits, harm, and something. Irreparable harm. That's what, what I was going for.
Let's say we concede that. I don't know that their irreparable harm argument is fantastic here. And it's a really, really short section. It is page 17 of their brief. They say courts presume irreparable harm in cases involving constitutional violations. A constitutional violation for even minimal periods of time unquestionably constitutes irreparable injury because this is unconstitutional, right? Because it allegedly violates the anti-commandeering doctrine. It causes irreparable harm to the states.
Is that true?
That seems, well, look, like the citations for courts presume irreparable harm in cases involving constitutional violations are things like restrictions on free speech, right? Mm-hmm. Things that, right, prevent individuals from exercising their constitutional rights. I have never seen that applied in the context of, oh, this is an unconstitutional thing to do to a state. And that seems a little tenuous to me in the sense that, like, a state is not an entity that can feel pain, right?
Yeah.
That can have, you know, its particular rights violated, right? Like, it's just a question of, is this permissible or not? So that seems like not a great argument. Their fallback argument is this. Even without that presumption, the court would have to conclude that the tax mandate, that's section C2, causes irreparable harm. Why? Sidebar, if you're an aspiring young lawyer, don't put rhetorical questions in your briefs. Anyway, because the mandate causes precisely the same harm that occurs every time the federal government intrudes upon the sovereign interests of the states. All states have an interest as sovereigns in exercising the power to create and enforce a legal code. That is why states have standing to challenge federal laws that purport to constrain that power. And that is why the federal government always causes a form of irreparable harm when it improperly interferes with the state's freedom to govern itself. The state's mandate causes precisely that form of harm. It constrains the state's taxing power, interfering with its sovereignty, and thus causing irreparable harm. Again, this does not seem to me to be a great argument, particularly if you're, you know, a textualist on the Supreme Court. The way in which we figure out whether a harm is irreparable or reparable is to ask, that's right. What would happen if we're wrong and we have to go back and revisit this? And the answer to what would happen if we're wrong and we would have to go revisit this is
move some money around.
You can. Yeah. Turns out you can spend some money in a different way after all.
Yeah.
That does
sounds
not
pretty reparable
seem
reparable to me.
Yeah, right. That like the reparation is within the declaration itself, right? Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah. We told you couldn't spend your money this way. Turns out you can. Go nuts, right? The last argument is one that has a single citation, and it's very weird. And I started to research it and just sort of ran out of time on today's episode. So I want to read it, flag it. Maybe we can crowdsource this. It says, the final way in which the tax mandate causes irreparable harm, this is page 18 of the Ohio motion. Subjecting Ohio to unknown penalties if it reduces taxes. the mandate causes an interference with the state's orderly management of its fiscal affairs. And the citation is to a case called Barnes versus E-Systems, 501 U.S. 1301, 1304. And then there is a citation I have never seen. I've only been practicing law for 20 years. But it says Scalia J. in Chambers.
What?
And what does that mean?
I think it means the ghost of Scalia visited one of them in their chambers and told them something. And
it's a weird, it's a very weird citation. Anyway, that injury cannot be remediated later. There is no mechanism for holding the United States responsible for the unquantifiable injuries Ohio will sustain if made to craft its tax policy in the mandate's shadow. That's the end of the stated argument. And if you're saying, I'm not sure I understand what that means, that's because it's deliberately written in an obtuse way. Here's what I think it is saying. I think it is saying the American Recovery Plan Act says you get the money, and then it says you cannot use the money on tax cuts. But it doesn't specifically say what the penalty is if the states do it anyway, right? The implied penalty is you'd have to disgorge the money. But there seems to be an argument here that that uncertainty would potentially change the balance of power vis-a-vis the state of Ohio and the federal government. So the key thing really is to check out that Barnes versus E-Systems case. You can tell from all of this, like, I ran a lot of things to ground, but that was still an open question as of the time that we record this. You know, this lawsuit was filed yesterday. So, you know, I cut me a little bit of a break. Let's put a pin in that as kind of a question for...
for everybody. It's not just for me.
Yeah. Future follow-up, is this really a good argument on irreparable harm?
Just because the listeners aren't used to having pins put in them like I do all the time. Get ready for Andrew to say, take that pin out, and then you have to pretend you remember what even the pin was. You're like, oh yeah, got one right here. I actually keep spare pins just in case. So it's like, yep, here it is. That one. And then he tells you what it was.
Yep.
Andrew, you didn't listen to any of that, did you?
I did not.
Okay, good. It was just me in the audience for a second.
Yeah, I was paging back to an additional point. Because here's the thing. Even if you concede irreparable harm, as you correctly noted, the first criterion for being able is, right, demonstrating a likelihood of success on the merits. And I don't see how they can do that.
So this will be a big signal. If this goes the wrong way, that probably means the court wants to just develop a stupid thing to let them do this.
Well, and look, yes, but again, think about this procedurally, right? This is filed in the Southern District of Ohio right now.
Right. I mean, if it got up to the Supreme Court, I guess is what I was saying. Yeah.
Right. So, but that's what we're looking for is, does this court issue an injunction blocking C2 from going into effect? And then if so, it strikes me as very, very unlikely, right? Because even if you do want to expand the anti-commandeering doctrine at the Supreme Court level, if you're a lower court, you kind of have to look at this and say, this does not seem to fit the facts of our three narrow anti-commandeering cases, right? There is no direct instruction to the legislature to do something. So you have the difference between, right, an affirmative command versus a negative, right? And think about this, right? If I were briefing this on behalf of the administration, the first point that I would make here is by analogy to writs of Matt Damon, right?
It's writs of mandamus, everybody.
Right. Yeah. Thank you. You cannot get a writ of mandamus to tell an elected official not to do a thing because there are an infinite number of ways not to do a thing. Now, you can get a negative injunction to say, hey, you know, don't violate the civil rights of so-and-so. But you can't get a writ of mandamus to do that because there's not a thing you're asking it to do, right? You would get a negative injunction. It would be a different standard. And I think by comparison, if the anti-commandeering doctrine is to have any force, right, it is to say, right, that the justification is a separation of powers justification. It does not violate the separation of powers to tell a state not to do a thing because, again, there are lots of different ways that they can not do that thing. And that's perfectly obvious in the case of tax cuts to say, okay, you can't use these dollars to offset a tax cut, but you could literally use anything else in your state's tax code to offset a tax cut, right? You have a literally infinite amount of options available to you as the state of Ohio to figure out how you want to tax and spend. So there is no good argument that this impermissibly tramples the system of federalism that allows states to remain sovereign. The Ohio argument talks about the magnitude of the money, right? Says, oh, look, like our previous cases that have held no commandeering when it's been a smaller amount of money, right? Like the highway funds and the drinking age, you know, this is could be up to seven, what is it on page 12? Yeah, equals roughly 7.4% of Ohio's total budget for 2020. And they're like, so that feels really, really coercive, right? Because it's a lot of money. But that's the wrong inquiry. The question is not how coercive is money. I can concede that money can be coercive to a state. And it is. And there are a lot of doctrines that say.
But it's still federal money.
Yeah, right. And you are not demanding that they do a thing. You are saying, if you want this money, you have to use your discretion to allocate this money subject to these kinds of constraints. And if that's impermissible, then our entire federal government is impermissible, right? Yeah.
So if I were to Thomas summarize this, it sounds like this is a totally stupid, dumb thing, but we really need to pay attention to it because if the Supreme Court decides, then it'll just be a stupid, dumb thing that becomes law. I don't know how they would do that, though. It seems like it would render a lot of what the government does, as you're saying, as unconstitutional. That would be a big hammer blow. But with this Supreme Court, you just never know.
You don't. But let me add, it would also neuter most of the Republican alternatives that have been proposed over the last 30 years, right? So, for example, and many of which have been adopted, right? So the idea is, oh, rather than have the federal government administer a program, we have the federal government give block grants to states. Right, the block grant
stuff, yeah. Right. That was Paul Ryan's big thing that he loved.
Right.
So much.
Block grants would be if this violates the anti-commandeering doctrine, then I fail to see how block grants violate the
block grant thing, I think, is a Republican compromise. Like, I think they would be fine with this, though, because they'd be like, oh, we'll still do the block grants and then states just do whatever because we don't care. I don't know. I kind of feel like Republicans would take that bargain is all I'm saying.
Well, my point is just that it would have the most immediate effects would be to undo Republican programs rather than Democratic programs, you know, like, for example,
right.
You know, it doesn't violate the anti-commandeering doctrine to have federal Social Security payments, right? Like the classic liberalism
falls a good point.
Outside of this doctrine.
It
this
would is really, encourage yeah. Democrats to not do the thing you said they did in this bill. It'd be like, oh, okay, well, I guess we can't, you know, give money to the states and, you know, I guess we'll just have to have the federal government be big brother and do everything. I feel like that. So I guess that would cut against Republican interests probably.
Right.
to push Democrats that way. That makes sense.
And there's one more thing that I think will protect the American Rescue Plan here. And we don't have time to dwell all the way into it. But that is the severability doctrine. And the question is, when you go to enjoin or strike down a provision of the bill, a court has to determine whether that provision is severable from the provisions around it and from the rest of the legislation. Now here, Section 9901 is very clearly severable, right? Like the money is allocated separately. So, you know, this bill is described as a $1.9 trillion bill, but in each section, it adds up the specific amount that are allocated in that section. So 9901 begins on page 220 with, okay, we're going to set aside $235 billion here for everything that follows. And of that $235 billion, $195 billion is going to the states under this particular formula. So 9901 is definitely severable from the rest of the bill, which is good because, you know, for example, the direct payments have already gone out. Some people have them in their bank accounts as we're speaking. Yeah. So it's not going to enjoin the whole act. You could keep it separate. But the idea that you could keep C1, which specifies the money, that would be severable from C2, which is how the money is spent.
Yeah.
That seems like super hard argument. And again, if I were briefing this on behalf of the United States, it would be very, very simple to say, you know, in the alternative, you have to enjoin all of sections 9901, right? Like you can't take the money and then say, ha ha, but I'm going to spend it however the hell I want. And that, by the way, you then would very easily be able to demonstrate irreparable harm because Ohio, I suspect, has a balanced budget amendment. So in other words, if the money is not there from the federal government, it becomes fungible. The federal government can and does borrow money all the time. But if Ohio gets the money and spends it, squanders it on stupid tax cuts, and then an appellate court says, oh, turns out you couldn't do that, Ohio could just shrug its shoulders and be like, yeah, well, we don't have that money anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, tough. So, I think all the equities run the other way, and I feel like things are going to be safe. But totally thought it was worth figuring out what Ohio is doing so we can keep our eyes on Ohio and the courts and maybe understand a little bit more about the anti-commandeering doctrine of 1992.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time for T3BE. I'm on an improbable streak, Andrew. One in a row. I don't know if I've ever had better than one in a row on this new test. No, I feel like I got two in a row, but that was the previous high. Let's see how fluky my last getting it right was on this week's T3BE. Don't pork the streak. Don't pork the streak.
All right, Thomas.
Oh, my God. The test found out I got one right, and now we have a 9-paragraph question. Okay, cool.
But this is a con law question, so I think you've got a puncher's chance here, right?
Yeah, it's a good word for it. Yeah.
A man owned a house where he was living with his family. The man was convicted of selling large quantities of an illegal drug from his house. Okay. Acting under a state law authorizing the destruction of buildings that are used for illegal activity.
Wow.
Yeah. The city destroyed the man's house.
Oh, my God.
The man's family then rented an apartment and demanded that the city pay the rent for that temporary residence. The family relied on a state law providing that any person who was dispossessed of his or her place of residence because of the actions of city officials was entitled to replacement housing at the city's expense until a permanent substitute housing could be found. When the city refused to pay the rent for the apartment, the man's family sued the city in a state trial court, claiming a right to such payment under both the state law and the due process clause of the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution. The state's highest court ruled for the family. Although the state decided that the family had no right to payment under the state law, it held that the 14th Amendment entitled the family to payment of the rent for the temporary apartment. In its opinion, the highest state court indicated that in several of its decisions, it had found cities liable for compensation in similar situations on the basis of the due process clause of the state constitution. But the highest state court, the state Supreme Court, declined to base its holding on the state constitution because the issue had not been properly raised in the case. The city then filed a petition for writ of certiorari to the United States Supreme Court.
Okay.
Does the court have jurisdiction to review the merits this case? Okay. Answers. A, yes, because the highest state court based its decision wholly on federal law grounds. B, yes, because the federal and state law issues in this case are so intertwined that a resolution of the federal law issue is necessary to facilitate a proper determination of the state law issues.
Yikes.
C, no, because the decision of the state of the highest state court renders the case moot, or D, no, because independent state law grounds could have been used to justify the result in this case.
Oh, man. This is, God. So we've had something related to this. So look, I know we've had something related to this, and, you know, that there is the idea this was the one weird trick with some of these abortion thingies that we were talking about under Trump, where it's like the way to get around some of this stuff is do it entirely based on state law, because then the Supreme Court can't touch it. So that was the whole like plan. And so this kind of loosely relates to that, but it tries to make this weird tortured construction of like, well, it has based this on the state version of the equal protection thingy in the past. But in this case, it said it's only on the 14th Amendment. It's an incredibly weird construction here. All right, let's look at what the ruling actually was. The highest court, state court, ruled for the family. Although the court decided the family had no right to payment under state law, it held that the 14th Amendment entitled the family to payment of the rent for the temporary apartment. In its opinion, the highest state court indicated that in several of its decisions, it had found cities liable for compensation in similar situations on the basis of due process clause of the state constitution. But the highest state court declined to base its holding on the state constitution because that issue had not been properly raised in the case. Okay, I have a few impulses here. For one, that strikes me as this was based on federal law. So yes. So like A was like obvious. A is yes, because the highest state court based its decisions wholly on federal law grounds. And then when you read B, I was like, oh, is this going to be the way the test porks me? Let's see how the test porks me. B, yes, because the federal and state law issues in this case are so intertwined that a resolution of the federal law issues is necessary to facilitate a proper determination of the state law issues. That sounds plausible, but it honestly kind of doesn't sound like it applies to this. That sounds like it would be if it... Okay, here's my impulse. I feel like there's a lot of dicta here. I feel like this, what actually happened and what's important to the question is state court says 14th Amendment gives them the thingy. Like I feel like that's what goes into LexisNexis. And that's what matters. Like the state court said, 14th Amendment gives you the thingy. And yes, in the dicta, in the opinion, they're like, well, it's because of the state kind of blah, 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 blah. I just feel like that maybe isn't as important. I think the bottom line is what matters, maybe, is kind of my inclination. Like, yeah, there's the state law stuff and the explanation for what they're doing. But at the end of the day, what you're going to see when you LexisNexis this is state court says federal law gives thingy, whatever, 14th Amendment. So I think B is an attractive distractor, maybe, although it, you know, who knows, but I think not B. A is where I'm solidly leaning toward. And then they threw C at us, which I think is total crap. C is if it's absolutely porkage to the extreme, it'd be C, which is no, because the decision of the highest state court renders the case moot. I don't think that could be true, but, you know, subject to porkage later. D, no, because independent state law grounds could have been used to justify the result in this case. That's the one where, just based on my experience of being porked over and over and over and over, I feel like D is going to be the stupid answer that's right. No, because state law could have been used. So it's like, that is really screaming out to me as that's going to be the dumb way that this question is tricky. Because otherwise, it seems like yes, because the highest state court based its decision wholly on federal law grounds. I cannot describe, and it's going to be funny if I'm totally full of crap, but I cannot tell you how much my intuition is telling me that D is going to be the way that this pork test tells me is the answer. Because I absolutely logically want to say A, because look, the court said 14th Amendment, absolutely you can appeal that. It says, does the court have jurisdiction? I feel, oh man, that's because that's got to be an even wider latitude. For a second, I was answering this as though more like, would they grant the writ of certiorari? And I feel like you could decline on the grounds of like, no, because state law could have, like that could have been a good justification to decline. But I think it would be really tough to say the Supreme Court can't look at this. That feels impossible. Could that possibly be right? It's got to be a yes answer. All right, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to guess A. I've just from, again, my intuition on this test, having gotten just screwed 100 times by this, well, I exaggerate, 10 or 15 times by this pork test. Porkage wise, I think it could be D in a weird way. And I think it would be like, yeah, we just don't want to mess with it. Like if there's a state law that would justify it, we don't want to bother overturning it on the federal level so that you then would have to like redo it on the state grounds and it was just pleaded incorrectly. God, I really want to pick D. Oh man. Here's the thing. I've had enough of this pork test. This is going to be the time that it's not a porked answer and I'm going to get wrong. I don't care. I'm going to guess D. I don't know why it's screaming at me. I feel like it's got to be D. Probably should be A. I'm going with D, Andrew. Final answer.
All right. And if you want to play along with Thomas, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag T3BE. Include your guess, your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and shower that winner with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
And thank you.
And now it's time to thank our new patrons, patreon.com/law. And Andrew, time for you to go first.
Thank you to Steak Solo, their ground beef. Thanks to Morgan is my favorite OA lawyer. Andrew is a close second. Well, you may get more of what you wish for in the coming years. Become a Patreon supporter because of accurate information about $15 an hour minimum wage. Thank you so much. Really, really appreciate that. I'm glad that there are folks out there that appreciate that. Whenever we tackle a tough subject, we get some backlash, but it's nice to get some attaboys as well. Thanks to Rebecca Moore, to Hannah Abbott, to Caitlin by the window, to Ethan Wall, to Ken Kubo, to Aegis Wren's Dyson Sphere. Oh, I'm all set to move to a Dyson Sphere, baby. To Sithkler and to Jonathan R. Take it away, Thomas.
And thank you to Jason and Elizabeth McQuain, Brendan Beely, longtime friend of the show, now friend with benefits. Yeah. Michael DePaula, Caleb Bullock, Thomas Townley, Taylor Losher, Kendrick Fortune. Oh, what a name. Kendrick Fortune.
That's Max Power kind of name.
I was going to say, yeah, what is Kendrick Fortune doing? That's like comic book billionaire Kendrick Fortune or something, or like Pixar movie. You know, billionaire inventor Kendrick Fortune. That's what I think. Yeah, there you go. David, Spaceball One, they've gone to Plaid. God, as a kid, that was the funniest joke in my... I laughed at that for hours. I don't know why it was so funny as a kid.
I'm still laughing at it.
Yeah, they've gone to Plaid.
They must have overshot us by a week and a half.
And finally, Hugh Janus. I'm just leaving a lot of space in between the first and last name there. It's Hugh, first name, last name Janus. Anyway, those people, hopefully, patrons will be enjoying a lot of awful movies. Cop Rock with Eli Bosnick. You don't want to miss it. Oh, it's going to be so much fun. Look for that this weekend. And that's our show. Andrew, reminder, get that stereo app and check us out every Wednesday at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. We had a lot of fun last night. It's so much fun. We got to hear a lot of important questions, by the way, a lot of questions about just current events, stuff that's important to people, and we get to hear it in their voices. So that's a great reason why you should jump on that stereo app, get it on your phone, follow at Torres or at SiriusPod, and each and every Wednesday you can ask us questions and participate with the show.
Absolutely.
All right. We'll see you next time.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it will be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.